Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 192, I have the pleasure of being joined by three retina specialists in solo private practice. We have a roundtable discussion about the issues facing solo practice, how they got to where they did, and what sort of tips and pointers they have for fellows who are or attendings interested in solo practice. Remember that a list of financial disclosures will accompany this episode. And remember, you can also claim CME for select podcast episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retina specialists who are in solo private practice. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Nora Khatib, whose practice is Eye and Retina Institute of San Diego. Dr. Khatib, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And next back on the program, Dr. Geeta Lalwani, whose practice is Rocky Mountain Retina Associates in Boulder, Colorado. Dr. Lalwani, thanks for being here with us.
Thank you for including me, Jay. Happy to be back.
So this idea came about because I think that going solo as a retina specialist can seem very daunting for people who are in training or even people out in practice. And there's definitely pros and cons. And I decided to pick two people I know who are doing solo practice to come and talk about it. So let's start here, and we'll work back and forth. So Geeta, why did you choose to go solo? And give listeners some background. Did you work somewhere else before? Where was it? And why did you decide to switch?
Sure. So I initially, following my fellowship, I was at Bascom Palmer for several years, about 4 years. And then I did make the jump into a private practice. And after a relatively short time, it was clearly not a good fit. So at that point, I decided to consider opening up, starting my own practice. And Boulder sort of was natural for me because this is my hometown. And it happened quite serendipitously. I was home visiting, and my parents have bugged me for years about coming home, saying there was no retina in Boulder, Colorado, and I couldn't believe it. And I actually did some sleuthing, and indeed at that time, there really was nobody here in Boulder who was practicing surgical retina. So that's sort of what initially, you know, gave me some food for thought. And the more I thought about it, the more, given sort of my experience, the more I decided that I could not only start a practice and be viable, but I could control and create the kind of practice that I wanted to be in.
Nora, how about you? So just to give listeners some background, post-fellowship, did you go straight into solo practice or did you work at a different job? And then why did you choose to go solo?
Sure. So I had gone straight from fellowship into solo practice. And I have to say, it was not an easy decision. So I did interview for a number of different positions in academics, in private practice, hybrid models with private and academic. And I ultimately decided that based on the contracts that I had reviewed, that none of them was appealing enough for me to decide, yes, I'm going to commit to this. And this is, you know, 100% right for me. I think it's really important to gauge and see if things are aligning with your interests when you select a job and a position. And I think coming out of fellowship, that can be very, very challenging. But I talked to several people, and I've heard so many times people who have taken a position and then after 4 or 5 years or after becoming a partner or when they're up for partnership, things don't seem to work out and people end up leaving or starting something on their own. So I was actually inspired by those stories and thought, well, why not just go straight into solo practice? That way I'm kind of taking that shortcut and being where I want to be. And one of my mentors had mentioned that the job that you're least likely to leave is the one that you start on your own. So the most important thing for me in looking for a job was long-term potential. In addition to that, having more control over my environment and time and practice efficiency was very appealing.
Nora, I commend you hugely because I came out of a situation where I'd already practiced retina for, 5 or 6 years and then started my own. I'm curious what it was like for you to start out on your own, not only, you know, continuing sort of the medical practice of retina, but now also the administrative aspects.
Yeah, so fortunately, I was able to find a situation where I was able to share office space with an ophthalmologist who had been in practice for almost 40 years. So I did have advice and mentorship through him.
Yeah.
So my father's also been in private practice for about 30 years. So I had a lot of advice from him as well in terms of how to manage the administrative side of the practice. So I was very fortunate with my situation.
Nora and Gita, I apologize, but we actually are being joined by another solo practitioner. We invited this call, Dr. Nadeem Vaidya, who is in Southern California. His practice is Retina Orange County. And Nadeem's going to tell us a little bit about why he decided to go solo. And Nadeem, did you work a different job before joining and starting your own practice?
I did. I worked for 2 years as an associate in New York. But back in 2012, I just decided, for a few reasons, to kind of start up my own practice. I realized I wanted to make the decisions for my practice, and I wanted to leverage tech to kind of streamline the major parts of the practice and try to be as cutting edge as I could, pretty much with kind of all aspects of the practice, not only like the diagnosis and treatment, but the business and management side of it too. And last but not least, my wife and I were kind of starting to think about starting a family. And at the time, we didn't feel like New York was the easy place to raise kids. So we wanted a more family-friendly location. But at least at that point, there wasn't any kind of job that was available. And we thought that that would be a great time to, or a great opportunity, I think, to open up my own practice.
And moving forward, Gita, and I'm going to let you guys all comment, at the risk of sounding completely ignorant, and I have to really admit to some ignorance here, how do you even start hanging a shingle or going solo? Like, logistically, and again, this may be basic, but if someone's in fellowship or in practice, like, you know what, I'm going to go solo in X area, what are the logistics of actually doing that in terms, obviously you have to find a place to work, you have to find a place to operate, but what about other logistical steps in terms of, you know, hiring a staff or figuring out what your needs are and what your overhead's going to be relative to projected revenue?
Sure. So I think so. The most important thing I think of what you do is to pick the right location, and that right location has many different meanings. It means not only where there's a need for retina, but it's also where you want to be for the rest of your life. This is something that you're in it long term. It is not something that you're going to leave, as Nora mentioned. So having said that, you pick your, pick your general location. For me, I feel like it was an endless, endless, endless list of things to do. Your first thing is to think about insurance contracting and credentialing and what hospital you want to operate at, if they have retina equipment. So I did. I would make different lists and each day go through X amount of them in terms of, where I wanted to be. You need an address and you need a fax number. Those are the two things you need off the bat, because otherwise you cannot start your credentialing process. So that's the number one thing you need. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to sign your lease or whatnot, but you do have to have an operating address. For me, I found it, to be honest, a little bit both haphazard and serendipitous. Similar to Nora, I met an ophthalmologist in practice who helped me along the way. I do find there's a really lovely network of people who are in solo practice who are very willing to help and give you information. I should mention, Doug Mayer is a retina specialist in Salt Lake City who I have never personally met, but we have exchanged thousands of text messages and emails and phone calls as he helped me as I started on my practice. I don't know. It's hard for me to say that it was a very direct way of doing things, only that you need to figure out where you want to work, where you're going to operate, and how you're going to get paid.
And speaking of getting paid, and Nora, you can talk a little bit about, again, what were kind of the first steps you did. But when you were planning, did you plan to supplement your income in other ways besides your practice, such as hospital coverage, moonlighting? Was there anything else you did to kind of either improve referrals or just boost your income?
Yeah, so I plan to take hospital call. And yes, it's a general ophthalmology call, but it allows you to network with other physicians within the hospital, and also other ophthalmologists who may need help with a patient when you're not on call that has a retina issue. So then they start to get to know you a little bit better. You start to develop a referral network. And fortunately, where I am, the hospital call is paid. So that was very helpful. And then by chance, I happened to connect with some ophthalmologists here in San Diego who were looking for someone to fill in for a retina specialist who had recently retired. So I was also able to work there one day a week.
Nadeem, what are your thoughts in terms of, again, if someone's starting, how they can improve referrals from the community? Is hospital call moonlighting something they should pursue? How do you balance that with kind of focusing energies on building your own practice?
That's a good question. I did start taking hospital call at the beginning. I found that it wasn't really great, not only for the fact that, you know, most of the patients that are coming through the hospital call, weren't insured necessarily. And for the vast majority of them, they didn't have other physicians that they were going to see. So it's not like I was getting many referrals from their doctors that were sending them to the ER, supposedly. That being said, I actually found that, you know, changing referral patterns is very difficult to already establish referral patterns that are in the community. And I found that, you know, the best, you know, there were two things that I found that actually were very helpful. And one was just plain word of mouth and patients finding you, starting to go to you, and you sending them back to their doctors, having done good work, hopefully. The other thing actually was kind of marketing directly to the patients and, you know, marketing via Google, marketing via Yelp, and kind of providing patients the opportunity to pick their own provider, which more and more, I think a lot of patients are doing. I did do all the things that you are supposed to do. And, you know, I went to go out and meet referrers. I brought out cards, bagels, donuts, cupcakes. I even brought angel tickets at one point. frankly, none of that worked. None of that, you know, really was very high yield, or at least I couldn't measure it. What I could measure was how many patients I was finding via Google AdWords. And it, you know, was about at least a 10-to-1 return on investment.
Gita, any thoughts on what Nadeem was mentioning about kind of referral patterns? I mean, did you, and again, I think every area, this is, again, uneducated academic junior doctor here, but I think every area is probably a little different in terms of breaking referral patterns. But I would say, I guess the interesting thing, and we can talk about this issue, when you do move into an area solo, how do you interface initially with the existing retina practices in the community, referring doctors? And then one thing that really drives referrals, unfortunately, more and more is insurance coverage, right? So how do you get on the insurance plans in an expedient fashion where, again, you're not negotiating as part as a group, you're negotiating as a single provider?
Sure. So I'll start backwards. So I came into an area which I think was relatively underserved. So for the most part, getting onto panels was not difficult. I also did find that in this area, there's an Independent Physicians Association, IPA. So I joined that, and that's very helpful if you have access to that into being immediately added on into insurance panels. And so then going backwards, you know, for me, there is definitely interaction with other retina specialists to a mild degree, but it's a very collegial environment for the most part. What I found interesting about Colorado was that I think the majority of my patients come through optometrical referrals because that it seems to be the nature of Colorado. And I think that's going to keep going in that direction as optometrists are picking up more and more of the eye care, at least the medical aspects as opposed to the surgical aspects. So I do a lot of CMEs for optometrists. I do a lot of handshaking, similar to what Nadeem said, and it for me has been a much better return on investment than, you know, the Googles. I was impressed and surprised to hear that. I'd love to talk more offline actually to hear your thoughts on that. But I have got definitely much more return by actually meeting face to face with other optometrists. And then at the end of the day, you take care of the patient. I think that's the number one thing you can do is do a good job with your patient. So your ability and affability are strong motivators for referrals.
It's an interesting concept, and again, we may not have all this data in front of us, but for example, there may be correlation. For example, services like Yelp for restaurants are utilized much more in certain, even though they're utilized everywhere, they're utilized much more by the population percentage-wise in certain areas than others. And I wonder, there is an impact, I'm sure, everywhere to online advertising. I wonder if it is more in certain areas, so there's Southern California, Orange County, maybe San Diego, and Oregon Comet, more than Colorado at this point, though I'm sure that the trends are moving in that direction as people move more and more online. Nadeem, any comments?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree to some extent. I think the only two places that I've known thus far practicing-wise is New York and Orange County, but which arguably maybe have a higher percentage of patients that are looking on Yelp. But I think for the vast majority, you know, most of us, I would say, don't go to a restaurant without at least checking their Yelp reviews. And if they're below a certain amount, we probably change our mind. And I think a lot of patients do that. And they kind of look and make sure and, you know, make sure that hopefully they're going to get not only good treatment, but, you know, treatment that kind of respects them as a, you know, as a patient. And I'd be surprised if there's anywhere in the country at the moment that doesn't have a fairly large percentage. And if you actually ask the patients, I would assume that they've looked you up on Google or Yelp or something. So I don't think it's just an Orange County thing or just a New York thing, but I would imagine that it would be the same elsewhere, but I can't say that for sure.
Nora, when we're talking about all this and we talked about referral patterns, how do you keep track of referrals and financials? And at this stage, you know, when you're starting your practice, obviously overhead's a concern. How do you handle the business side of your practice? Do you have a separate business manager? Do you have kind of staff who look at this? How much of this is quote unquote, you know, part of your job in terms of running the practice where you're doing this all on your own?
So yeah, as a solo practitioner, you learn to wear many, many hats throughout the day. Sometimes you are the business manager. Sometimes you're in your physician role. Sometimes you're a staff supervisor or even the biller. So there are many, many things that we're juggling at the same time, but that also keeps it fun and exciting for me. So initially, I was my own practice manager, and I would manage my referrals on my own. As I hired more staff, one of my staff is now in charge of all of the referrals, and they have these piles of who's been scheduled, who's pending, and who we haven't been able to schedule for after three or four attempts. In terms of financial aspects, those I manage myself at this time. There's a lot of software that's available that's very easy to use, things like Quicken or QuickBooks. So I use Quicken myself, and it's very easy to track what your expenses are month by month and to make a projection and to make sure that you're on track with whatever your projected goals may be. I think it's important to also work with a good financial advisor or have someone who you trust to give you some sound financial advice, especially in the early stages when it's hard to juggle the big startup expense with running the practice and the office.
You know, this is going to sound like, again, I love this conversation because I learned so much from it. But the Bay Area basic question that I wonder, Gita, who covers your patients when you're out, or are you always on call for the patients that you see?
I'm always available via phone. I'll always answer calls, even if I'm away or overseas. My staff can reach me. I can see messages and have access to my phone line when traveling. But for coverage, if a patient needs to be seen, I work with someone here locally who can cover me for that particular week or weekend.
How about you, Gita?
So very similar to Nora. I think you cover your own patients the majority of time. It does make it hard sometimes, though, Jay, because you do feel a little bit more pressed to be, quote unquote, on call all the time, even when you're, you know, at home. So mm-hmm. I do think that's one of the harder parts of being in solo practice. I mean, we have a fairly collegial environment here. So if I need to travel or whatnot, I do have people that I can hand off call. But it's the other, you know, 50 weeks a year or when you're home and you're still constantly available by phone. So I do think that's one of the harder aspects of being in solo practice by yourself.
And Nadeem, to that point, everyone always talks about, regardless of the practice you're in, the importance of availability.
And I think what Gita's referencing, especially in solo practice, not only for your own patients, but for referring doctors who call you, especially at the beginning, I'm sure there is a huge internal pressure and probably logical pressure to always be available. How do you balance that with, you know, you said you wanted to start a family, you know, you're married. How do you balance with that with trying to maintain a sane and slightly balanced life?
You know, I found that most of the time I'm not getting referrals on the weekends anyways, because my referrers are usually off on the weekends. And if I'm not taking a hospital call, I usually don't end up seeing a lot of at least new emergency patients over the weekend. And the fact of the matter is I mean, I also take my own call while I'm here, but I get maybe like one call a month over the weekend from a patient. And again, maybe Gita and Nora are a little bit more down the road, more longevity-wise in practice than I am. And maybe I just haven't hit that point yet, but I just don't find it to be all that busy. And, you know, frankly, I try to keep my weekends sacrosanct for my kids. You know, I think that it is something that you can kind of manage to your ability. And, you know, you don't have to take every patient. Yes, it's beneficial to be available, but it's not the end of the world if you miss one patient. Nobody's going to stop referring to you if you just can't see one retinal detachment one day.
I think that one of the nice things of being in practice is you really are the face of your practice, and you develop relationships with your referring doctors, perhaps differently than if you're in a larger practice. And to Nadim's point, you know, you do create relationships, and you can, you know, decide, say a call comes in over the weekend, how urgently does a patient actually need to be seen? Obviously, it depends a lot on the patient, but you can decide and say, hey, you know what, this is not going anywhere. We can wait till Monday. So I do think there's aspects that allow you to have better relationships with referring doctors, perhaps.
Absolutely, I agree.
And I think, again, this is a complete, you know, in the bubble kind of question, but it was something that would worry me. I mean, we all have our own things that stress us out, but if I was thinking, I'm just thinking from my perspective, if I'm leaving and pro fellowship or my job and I'm going into solo practice, you know, I think one of the most challenging things sometimes is getting somewhere to operate. And I think that when you join a practice, Nora referenced interviewing at practices, there's already kind of set up mechanisms like, okay, you know, you're going to operate at this place in this location. If you're going to multiple locations, you get credentialed at this hospital. You know, how easy is it, Gita, and pardon again my experience, to just approach an ASC or a hospital and say, hey, my name's Dr. So-and-so, I'm going to operate on X patients. And is there kind of, I don't know, again, this probably varies location, but I just feel like it interesting to think my bias would be you just don't have the same sort of cachet or pull to like get block time, mm-hmm. for example. Like, how do you, is that true? Or maybe that's just my perception, but I would just be concerned about no one's going to give me block time because I'm just this solo practitioner starting, I'm coming out of fellowship, and how am I going to get space to actually take care of patients when they come to me?
So I think it's only partially true. I mean, I think that applies, to be honest, wherever you go, having been in a private practice previous to this, block time does not come easy to anybody. When you're new, you're new. I don't think being in your own practice has that much to do with it. I think that in other ways, you know, you're developing a relationship with a hospital and you're trying to develop something that is mutually beneficial. It's if you can bring cases to their hospital, they are, I do find, are fairly supportive of working with you. It does mean that things are not perfect from day one because it hasn't been a well-oiled machine. So it does take more effort on your part, my part, to create that. But having said that, I mean, my OR situation right now is fantastic. I mean, I operate with the equipment that I want, the microscope that I want, anything that I want, I have access to. And that took a relatively short time to get to that point.
You know, Nora, I'll let us kind of finish by going around. And we've talked about a lot of things, and there's no way to cover everything in one 20, 25-minute podcast. But if you had one piece of advice for someone leaving fellowship who's like, you know, maybe I'm considering solo practice, besides, again, reaching out to people who have done it before, like Gita referenced and you referenced, what sort of tips would you give them about investigating this option?
I would say just make sure you do your due diligence and that you're sure that this is what you want to get into and what you want to try. I think there's some flexibility early in practice because I always thought, you know, if for some reason it doesn't take off, most people will leave or change their first job within, 50% will leave and find another job within 2 years. So it's not the end of the world. I think it's very fun option for those who are very committed and dedicated to it. It's not a, you know, clock in, clock out kind of job. It has a lot of variables and aspects to it. You can direct it whether you want to be more academic or strictly clinical. So it's very, very flexible. But I'd say, yeah, talking to other people who have done it, and go ahead and interview for jobs. I definitely recommend that you should see what's out there, and it gives you a point of comparison to see, you know, get a feel for what you're really looking for and what's going to get you to sign on the dotted line at the end of the day.
Nadeem, how about you? What would you tell somebody coming out of fellowship or looking to solo practice? Anything on top of what Nora said?
I mean, I think the basic thing is that I think we all hear during residency and fellowship that solo practice is dead, and it certainly is not dead. While it's hard to kind of do all of the aspects of solo practice, and there are, you know, regulatory financial things that you need to do, it's not that hard to actually make money as a physician or in solo practice. So don't be afraid to start up your own practice if that's what you know you want to do. That being said, I actually probably wouldn't strongly suggest doing this straight out of fellowship. And I don't know if the others agree with that, but I think it actually benefits you to see what practice is like outside of academics, outside of fellowship, outside of residency. Because I think private practice in general, and solo practice, of course, as well, is a completely different animal. But I think it's certainly still a viable method of practice.
Gita, any final words of wisdom?
Yeah, I think I have three points of advice. I would think about it, you know, if I could advise somebody. One is, for sure, when you're in fellowship, learn the medicine, you know, the medical surgical aspects of retina as well as you possibly can. I do think the learning curve on retina as you come out is somewhat steeper than other specialties. So you need to be strong, because at the end of the day, the most important person is the patient. Number one. Number two, learn how to bill. Nobody learns how to bill. And whether you go into solo or other kinds of private practice, or even probably academics, Jay, I think learning how to bill is a crucial skill that nobody teaches. And then three, if you decide that solo practice is for you, and I tend to agree with Nadeem that I probably wouldn't recommend it directly out of fellowship, but that's why I give kudos to Nora for having done so, that start out as lean as you can. If the leaner you are in the first 2 years, the better you will sleep at night. And I can promise you, within 2 years, you'll be able to buy every toy and whatnot that you want. Because as Nadeem says, you can make money in private practice on your own. But it's better to manage the financial aspects early and make that mountain as low as possible.
Well, guys, thank you so much for your time. Nadeem, thank you for joining us after we started and adding your input. And I think the listeners and the fellows and also the attendings like me who listen learned a lot from it and will learn a lot from listening to it. So thank you all for your time. And hopefully I'll see all, if not all of you, some of you at Academy. So thank you guys again.
Super, Jay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 192 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. In addition, you can find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils, on the website. Remember, you can now claim CME credits for select podcasts via the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcasts and Android Store. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback for things we can do better and things we're already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via the Apple Store or Android Store to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Gita Lalwani, Nora Khatib, and Nadeem Vaidya for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venicasa for preparing this episode and the social media that accompanies it. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.